Welcome to the Clear Admit MBA Admissions Podcast. I'm Graham Richmond, and this is your Wiretaps for Monday, November 23rd, 2020. I'm joined by Alex Brown. As always, Alex, how are things?
Very good, thank you, Graham. Locking down and staying safe.
Yeah, I'll bet. So this week is, I guess it's Thanksgiving week, although not celebrated much in the UK. are you going to be doing anything? Do you do anything for Thanksgiving, given that you lived in America for a long time?
No, quite honestly, yeah.
No.
Even if we weren't locked down, I probably wouldn't be doing anything special other than going to the pub.
Right, okay. So, since it's kind of getting towards Thanksgiving, I wanted to give thanks to Alexandra Kelly, who produces this podcast week in and week out. Literally like every, Friday of the week prior to this release, she's always sitting around producing this. So I wanted to give her props for all the great work she does on this. Other stuff that we wanted to tackle, though, today, Alex, is that we've completed this sort of first batch of essay workshops. I had a lot of fun doing it. I was looking at the list, and we've now hosted Columbia, Chicago, Wharton, Berkeley, MIT, INSEAD, LBS, Cornell, Duke, Michigan, UNC, Texas, Carnegie Mellon, NYU Stern, and Georgetown on these workshops. And they've all shared really interesting insights about how they came up with their essay questions, what they look for. And this stuff is all online. Like, you can now go and watch the workshops. There's like video up from the webinars that we led. That's been a lot of fun. I know you played a really critical role in helping with the breakout rooms these last two workshops. So appreciate that. And I just want to encourage everyone to go and watch those if you're applying to any of the schools that I just mentioned in round two.
Yeah, no, quite frankly, Graham, they're great events. Well done. Yeah, very good.
Lots of fun. So I wanted to ask you about, there's been a news item in our space this week, and that is that last week, Michigan Ross has revealed that they are relaxing the test requirements going forward for this admission season, and they're going to allow you to request a waiver on the GMAT or GRE if you'd like. And because they're doing this kind of mid-season here, they're also, they stated that all the round one applicants will either be accepted come December, I can't remember the date, I want to say December 10 or whatever day it is that they release their decisions, or they will be waitlisted. So no one will be rejected. And the reason for that is that anyone who is waitlisted will have the option to also submit for a waiver, which I suppose means that the committee would then look at their file as part of round two without the test score, if they're approved for the waiver. You do have to get approved to get the waiver. So what do you make of this? I mean, this is something we've never seen before. I know that Darden and Sloan have this same process, but they announced it, before the season began. But what do you make of this?
Yeah, I mean, Michigan Ross is changing things up. They did actually push back their decision deadline from December 2nd to December 4th.
Okay.
At some point this season. So it's not the first change that they've incurred. But I'm a big believer, you're halfway through the game, changing the rules halfway through the game opens you up for some potential consequences, right? So we're halfway through round one. They've decided now to have the waiver in place, much like, as you mentioned, a couple of other schools have done at the beginning of the season. So that could be problematic. What they need to do now is make sure that the change in rule is entirely equitable. And what I mean by that is it's equitable to all candidates, whether they apply in rounds one, rounds two, or later rounds. So that's what they're trying to do, right? So they've made the decision for round two folks that you can waive the GMAT or the test score generally. So therefore, in round one, they're not denying anybody and giving the opportunity for folks to request that their test score is waived. And so on and so forth. So that's their attempt to provide that equitable sort of solution to this issue, which I think, maybe that is the right way to approach this. We had a little conversation before we went on air. What are the consequences of doing that? Will they really re-review a candidate knowing their test score, but waiving that score? How is that review process really going to work? And does it give them an option to potentially admit someone that they really like, But the test score was really weighing them down, and maybe they don't actually have to report that test score now to the ranking agencies or whatever it is. So they've obviously thought through all this stuff and are hoping to provide a fully equitable solution. One thing it will do, Graham, is it will create conversation on the wires.
Yeah, it's already creating some conversation. And I think, I mean, I get where they're coming from in the sense that, you know, they mentioned in the post that they put up on their website that they've had issues in round one where people are kind of saying, look, in my country, the online test isn't available, or I had to take the test at home, but my internet is awful and it went out midway through the exam. Or, you know,
Right.
there's been problems with at-home testing. And access. And so I get where they're coming from. I think it is challenging to make a change mid-season. But, you know, frankly, like they're a topic of conversation now. And it may spur some additional round two applications for the school if there are candidates out there who are, you know, don't really want to take a test or haven't taken it, and were worried they, you know, would have to wait another year or something. So there are a lot of possibilities. And as you pointed out, it may give them some flexibility in terms of who they admit. I think one of the things that's happened with the pandemic is it's raised a kind of it's brought to the fore this issue around standardized testing, which was already something in discussion. You know, is the test right? You know, obviously schools started taking the GRE and the GMAT. There's just been a lot of movement in this space, and I think the pandemic is accelerating a lot of it, like it's done in other areas too, with sort of online learning. So interesting stuff. We'll see how it develops.
Yeah, what I would say in my conversation yesterday with David Simpson during the breakout session for the essay workshops, we did actually talk about standardized test taking because the question to David was, is it true that LBS isn't as inclined to accept the GRE as North American schools typically are? And he put that rumor to rest and absolutely suggested that the GRE is at least equivalent to the GMAT in terms of their admissions process. So that was very good. But he did also make the point that, that being said, he's a massive believer in the GMAT test. It's worked for them over the years in terms of a measurement of success in their program and so on and so forth. So there are reasons why schools focus on these standardized tests. And obviously, the GMAT test is designed specifically for graduate business education. So I'm not sure it's all doom and gloom for the GMAT, but definitely the landscape is shifting.
Yeah, agreed. And I think that is a good point. And I think it really varies from school to school in terms of how they view the test and its role in their process. So is there anything else going on? I mean, I know we've had a really busy run with all these essay workshops, but anything else happening, or is this kind of, I mean, we're waiting now for decisions on a lot of those round one schools, but is there anything looming that you wanted to call our attention to?
No, I mean we're really in that lull period where schools are busy interviewing, and you know interviewing the candidates they've selected for interviews in most schools' cases. So in terms of deadlines coming up this week, there's really nothing official. There will be interview invites still rolling out for some schools for sure. But we are getting towards the end of the invite season, and then it's that sort of 1 or 2 week quiet period before boom, the beginning of December. Lots of decisions start coming out very quickly.
Yeah, makes sense. So I'll just run through a couple of things and then I want to get to the wiretaps candidates that you've picked out. We have three really great candidates and there's a kind of a common thread, which I love to see across candidacies. So a few things. Real Humans, we've done Kellogg and Columbia now. So those are up on the site. And I think our listeners remember we'd recently also done Wharton and Chicago. So a lot of top MBA programs, Real Humans profiles, which are always fun to read and useful, I think, for candidates as you're applying. We've got our big fall survey still running. I think by the time this podcast airs, there'll only be a few more days to take it, and we really need your help. So if you can take this survey, it's just so important us to learn about how you, as an applicant, make decisions about where to apply and where you get your information. You can take it at bit.ly/surveyfall2020. It's all one word. So please take the survey. It'll help us out immeasurably. And then the last thing I wanted to mention is that we still have the LiveWire data dashboard on the site, which is a way for you to manipulate LiveWire data and learn a lot more about basically your, you know, your chances and what's happened in the past with candidates. You can do really cool sorting and scatter plotting. So I recommend everyone sign up for that if you haven't, especially if you're someone who's kind of reeling from poor results in round one and kind of reconfiguring as you approach the second round. I think it's really useful to do some digging into the data. It's $20 for a month or $50 for a year. So please sign up for that if you can. Alex, anything else that you wanted to mention before we dive in and look at these wiretaps candidates?
No, let's get talking about the underwire guy.
I knew you were going to. Yeah, all right. So this is wiretaps candidate number one. So this person has four schools on their target list, and those schools are Berkeley, Duke, Michigan, and UCLA. They want to start business school next fall. They've been working as an accountant, and they want to get into, it looks like, consulting and then entrepreneurship. And they mentioned Deloitte as one possible company. GRE score, 326, GPA, 3.46, and they've been working for 5 years. The interesting tidbit is that they're kind of accountant by day, but underwear entrepreneur by night. They've started an underwear company on the side, and they don't have revenue yet, but they have the prototype. And they want to go to business school to sort of help grow that business. And they also mentioned that they did a one-year master's in accounting and have a CPA. The GPA in that master's of accounting was a 3.2, which is a little lower than their undergrad GPA. But they also offered up the fact that they studied humanities at the undergrad level and had no exposure to accounting, and then, you know, found themselves in this intense one-year program. So that's a little bit of the background. What do you make of this? I mean, you know, we don't see many people with a kind of underwear business on the side. So what do you make of this candidate?
Yeah, it's very interesting. There are a couple of things that this candidate will need to explain, and maybe a little bit more on the wires or whatever. But this idea that they went and got an accounting degree because they got a humanities major, was that to actually go into an accounting role, or were they already in an accounting role and realizing they needed to get the degree to get up to speed with the types of work they were doing? That was a bit unclear to me. Obviously, the 3.2 GPA in the accounting degree might raise an eyebrow. Usually when we see a master's degree from candidates, the GPAs with grade inflation and various other things are in the 3.8s and 3.9s, versus an undergrad might be 3.5s and 3.6s. So to see a 3.2 on the master's side is less usual. So making sure that is explained. I mean, the GRE is decent, I think, and the undergrad's probably pretty good. So I reckon the candidate will do well in the curriculum, but might need to explain this. And they did explain that, you know, they did the master's in accounting from scratch. They hadn't got an accounting undergraduate degree or whatever. So I'm sure that makes it a bit tricky. I wouldn't want to do that, and I had a business undergrad. So that needs explaining. And the idea that they have an underwear company, but they've got no revenue, I'd like to learn a little bit more about that. So what does it mean creating a prototype? I mean, what, you know, have they got some kind of intellectual property or some kind of design that's really going to make a huge impact? That was a little unclear to me, Graham. I do think the idea that they want to be an entrepreneur and it's underwear, that's quite sexy, right? I mean, it's different anyway. So that could definitely add colour to their storytelling in the essays, which we know is very important. And we talked about this a little bit before we came on air, whether the plan that they have going into consulting and then entrepreneurship makes sense, or whether they should either go directly into consumer goods, get some experience there to then go run their business, or maybe with their business partner go directly into the entrepreneurship, directly out of their MBA to make their journey a bit more sort of cogent and so forth.
Yeah.
So quite frankly, Graham, I think there's some good stuff here, but there's some queries here.
Yeah, I agree. I had some questions. I mean, we don't know, for example, is this men's underwear or women's underwear? I mean, that's one thing I was kind of wondering about. But I guess, you know, and you were making fun of me the other day for watching reruns of Seinfeld. But, you know, there actually was recently an episode that I saw where Kramer has to switch from briefs to boxers. So there's clearly, you know, still debate raging in the underwear world in terms of what's the most appropriate underwear. But I do think the thing for me, in all seriousness, about this candidate was that I was on board with this idea that, hey, they've got a prototype. They're, you know, they have this kind of interesting idea. And I was thinking, but wait, you're going to go to business school and then you're going to become a consultant, which is pretty plain vanilla, you know? And I was thinking, why aren't you just telling the story about, I don't know, at least get into apparel or go for it and just start your business. I mean, you've already kind of got it going. Mm. And so I didn't understand, you know, if you have a prototype, why do you then go off to business school for a couple of years, then consult, and then like what, 5 years later, you're going to pick this idea up again? Or are you doing it in parallel? I needed more clarity there. And I thought that they're missing a chance to differentiate by just kind of going all in on either, starting their own underwear business, or at minimum, differentiating along the lines of like wanting to work in apparel or fashion in some way. And I also wondered about school selection here, because if you think about it, you know, the whole kind of fashion industry in the U.S. tends to be centered in L.A. and New York. And so they have UCLA on the list, but then they, you know, I just kind of wondered whether or not, like, is there a reason they don't have a New York school on their list? And it could be personal preference, or there could be any number of reasons, right? But that was something that came to my mind as well. But I do agree, the numbers are pretty solid overall, and I think they can navigate that lower GPA in the master's because it's accounting, and they didn't study that as an undergrad. So I feel like they could navigate, and I almost wonder if they're aiming a little low. Like, I wonder if they could aim even higher, but we need some answers to the questions, as you correctly point out. But I like this candidate. I mean, they will be remembered as the underwear guy or gal when they apply, and that's actually worthwhile. That's my take.
Yeah, when I use the term guy, that is a gender neutral reference. I mean, we don't know their gender, and maybe that makes an impact or not. Right. But yeah, I mean, the underwear element, the entrepreneurial element, I think, makes a difference. And I think the idea of making sure they go to the right school, maybe, like you say, investigate some more schools in New York and so on and so forth. I think even Stern might even have a really good track for fashion and stuff like that. So examine this stuff and navigate the 3.2 GPA at the master's, which, as Graham, as you pointed out, should absolutely be navigatable, but will raise a little bit of a red flag without any explanation.
Yeah, agreed. So I think enough said there, but really interesting candidacy, and I wish them the best of luck. Let's move on and talk about Wiretap's candidate number two. So this person has 5 schools on the target list, and they are Cornell, Dartmouth, Duke, Kellogg, and UVA, and they want to start next fall. They have 3 years of experience at an expert network and 1 year of experience at a healthcare startup. They want to get into consulting, and they list a whole slew of companies, the usual suspects, of course, A.T. Kearney, Bain, BCG, Deloitte, Ernst & Young, McKinsey, and PwC. They even go further. They have some boutique firms that they're potentially interested in. They have a 730 on the GMAT and a 3.92 GPA, 4 years of work experience. They're located in North Carolina, and they want to end up on the East Coast or in the Midwest. This candidate also mentions that they're non-traditional and that they have a humanities degree from a liberal arts school. And so, you know, they're kind of wondering whether or not that means that their kind of quant side is going to be more closely scrutinized. And they mentioned they have a 48 on the GMAT quant, which is like a 67th percentile, I believe. But they did really well in college level calculus and statistics. So they're hoping that, you know, 3.92, good grades in quant courses, and a 730 overall in the GMAT will get them by. But they were curious about that. What do you make of this candidate?
Well, I wouldn't be concerned at all in terms of their academic chops handling the first year curriculum at any of the programs, certainly on their list or any program worldwide. We had a conversation about this before we came on air, Graham. This 48 quant you said is a 67th percentile. I wonder what 49 quant is. It probably jumps up to about 90 percentile or something ridiculous. I mean, it is, you know, very much skewed heavy right at the very top. You drop a point or whatever and it drops down precipitously. I do remember maybe 5 years ago, we were talking about 46 on the quant side being acceptable for these top programs in terms of that's the threshold you should be targeting. So this person's 2 points over that, so I wouldn't have any problem with this. When you combine it with the overall GMAT is ridiculously outstanding, the GPA ridiculously outstanding. So not a problem there, I don't think. Can you explain to me what this expert network is, Graham? Because I know you did your due diligence before we came on air, and I don't want to take your the thunder away from you, but it is important. And the reason why I ask you this, Graham, is again for this candidate and others' perspective, is make sure if you are a non-traditional candidate and your field won't be well understood, that you make it quite clear what you do and your accomplishments and so on and so forth through your application. But Graham, go ahead.
Yeah, so I had to educate myself. An expert network is a group of individuals. It could be scientists or any people with expertise in a certain domain who kind of band together and sell their services to businesses. And often, a common use case would be hedge funds. So hedge funds looking to maybe invest in a turbine company might consult with an expert network of like physicists or, engineers who have gotten together and know a ton about turbines and could evaluate, a business plan or a company's, strategy from a tech kind of standpoint.
Nice.
So I believe that's a sort of shorthand answer to it. But yeah, I had to look that up and that means they need to make sure they know how to explain this.
So there's two things that strike me here, Graham. One is we don't have to worry about ever participating in an expert network. But more importantly, this person's just used to being around phenomenal people, smart people, sharp people. And this person is obviously very smart themselves. So I think that's all very good. I mean, quite frankly, Graham, we talked about this a little bit again before we came on air. We think this candidate might be undershooting in terms of her target programs. I think is, am I saying that right? Her or do we know this person's gender?
I don't think we know, but I agree that like the first candidate, and that is to this week's common theme, I think, is that they might be undershooting. I wonder about that.
So they're non-traditional, which we like, right? The challenge for non-traditional is to absolutely make sure that you make a very compelling case of why the MBA is the next right step for you and make, obviously your post-MBA goals, make sure they're well developed, because oftentimes for non-traditional candidates, that aspect of the application is where they get a bit exposed. But for the most part, non-traditional candidates will bring a different voice to the classroom, to the conversations, and that's an absolute benefit to the MBA. So they're non-traditional. They got numbers out the wazoo, Graham. So absolutely, this candidate should be aiming high. Now, they've selected some great programs, so don't get me wrong. They've got one M7 and then the rest of them out of the top 16, as it were, if we categorize them like that. But I would think that they should be looking at least a couple more M7s to sort of mitigate the risk. If you only apply to one M7, that's quite risky, right? So apply to two or three to make sure that you get an opportunity at that level if they want to do that.
And the thing that I noted is that if you look at this list, Cornell, Dartmouth, Duke, Darden, and then Kellogg, you've got a bunch of schools that are incredibly, they're known for being close-knit. With the exception of Kellogg, they're also on the smaller side, and they're also in kind of more rural settings. They're not urban business schools. Kellogg is the exception here. But so I wondered maybe that's what they're looking for, in which case you look at the rest of the M7 and, most of them are bigger schools in urban centers.
Yeah.
Although, again, I do think this person might be undershooting a little bit. They can think about it. But, one key takeaway I had, Alex, is, maybe we should we be starting an expert network about business school, so that we could farm out our services to people who... but in all seriousness, I wonder about this candidate and whether they could add another school or two from M7. But yeah, we'd need to know more about what they're looking for. Because I get that some people want to be off in the woods for 2 years. I mean, it's a great way to unplug, especially with COVID. Maybe being away from densely populated areas is a nice thing, you know. So as you would know, Alex.
You're not selling them on Philadelphia, Graham?
Well, we always do that, right? And I mean, I will say that oddly enough, Wharton is a school that is has a really close-knit community because no one's from there, right? So when you go to these large schools in major urban centers, a lot of times a big chunk of the class like already knows Chicago or already was living in New York or whatever. So they have like existing social networks. Very few Wharton students are from Philly, although maybe that's changing as Philly's been coming up in the world. But it's, you know, tends to not be the place where people are living pre-business school. So it results in a close-knit community. Again, I think this person just should needs to take our advice and think about, okay, if I were to aim higher, what appeals to me? And, you know, that's what it comes down to for me.
Yeah. Totally agree. Great candidate. Much like, I mean, the first candidate, great, but I really like this candidate for sure.
All right, so let's move on and talk about our third candidate. This is Wiretap's candidate number 3. And this person has 5 schools on their list. They include Duke, Emory, UNC, UT Austin, and UVA. They also want to start next fall. This person's been working in advertising and marketing. And after business school, they're thinking about consulting or maybe consumer goods. Companies on the list are Accenture, Bain, BCG, Deloitte, Ernst & Young, and McKinsey. GMAT score, a 730, GPA 3.77, and 4 years of work experience to date. This person's located in Texas, and they would like to end up in the Southwest or South after business school. This person also tells us that by the time they matriculate, they'll have 4 years of working in the LA ad agency community. And they've had multiple promotions earlier in their career, and they're now managing a team of 3. They also shared with us that they studied at UT Austin for undergrad and are hoping to kind of come back to South Southwest with a plan A of consulting, plan B of CPG/brand management. So, Alex, you had some dialogue with this candidate. What do you make of their, you know, their candidacy overall?
Yeah, I mean, frankly, as we talked about with the last candidates, this candidate, I think, for sure, is undershooting. Again, the programs they've listed are very good programs, but, you know, they're very good programs in that sort of top 16 type category, even to the top 20 in this candidate's case. I am puzzled why they wouldn't have a shot at Wharton, have a shot at Kellogg, both absolutely outstanding for marketing, right? People think of Wharton when you don't really know Wharton, you just think it's a finance school, but its marketing faculty is absolutely top notch. And, you know, this person, they say their work experience is very good. They've got multiple promotions early in their career. They're now managing folks. So they really should be checking that box pretty effectively. I mean, they got a 730 on the GMAT, 377 GPA. So, you know, from a numbers standpoint, they're at par or above even the top programs. So I'm not sure why they're not necessarily targeting the very best. They're a little bit concerned about their lack of extracurriculars, but they were involved in their undergrad and so forth. So, you know, not everybody is saving the world in their spare time whilst they're sort of working 80 hours a week to qualify for a top tier MBA program. And this candidate, if they've shown a pattern of behavior of really getting involved in their undergrad, there might be good reasons why they're not as involved now. And that could be mitigated. And they definitely, I mean, the other thing that I'd say about this, and then we'll get into a particular tip that we wanted to address in this Wiretap series. But if you're a candidate, let's say, I mean, all right, they're applying or they're considering Duke, Emory, Keenan Flagler, Texas and Darden, Graham. Let's say those are the only 5 schools they apply to. They they get admitted at all five schools, they get scholarship money across the board. Is that a successful application strategy in your book?
No, if you get in everywhere, it means you probably didn't, you know, aim as high as you could have, right?
Right. I mean, that you should, unless you get admitted across the board, and that includes Harvard, Stanford, and or Wharton, if you get admitted across the board, you've not aimed high enough, right? That's just the pure and simple fact of sort of application strategy. So for this person, their goal should be to be denied at a program and then realize if, as long as they've sort of done a good job of sort of tapering, you know, the qualities of programs across the board, they'll end up getting admitted to the best program that they can get into. Absolutely, I think they need to at least include one or two M7s in this mix.
Yeah, I tend to agree. And also, we do get into this issue where they have UT Austin on the list. They went there for undergrad. And some people say, oh, avoid double dipping. Although if they love, I mean, that's where they're living now in Texas. And so if they love it there and they went there as an undergrad, I understand, right? But it does, the thing for me, as you correctly pointed out, I was like, why didn't this person go and study marketing at Kellogg or Wharton? They can name their location. They seem very focused. If you look at their school selection, it's all south, southeast. And so, you know, they seem like, and I get that, but so at some point when you get into the very upper echelons of these business schools, you can kind of go wherever you want, right? So yeah. I would encourage this person to cast a wider net. The other thing that happened in the dialogue that you had with them is you were like, hey, maybe add this school, add that school. There was some back and forth. And then suddenly they said, how am I going to get my recommenders to do 6+ applications? So I don't know. Did you want to talk at all about that? Because that's a great lesson here, I think, that for anyone listening, in terms of how to manage this process with recommenders.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't look at these schools in particular, Graham, but we know more and more schools are adopting the GMAT common letter of recommendation questions. Mm-hmm. So it's not like you can just use one common platform, but lots of schools are adopting the same question. So basically, go to the 6 or 8 schools that you're targeting, list out each of the questions for each of the schools, identify which are common, create a nice matrix so that your recommenders' work is minimized in that regard. And then you can also provide your recommenders, you know, some, you know, draft documents so that they can see your essays, they understand what you did. Like, just make the process as simple as you can for your recommenders. Obviously, you don't write these recommendations. That's a ridiculous idea. Some recommenders will ask you to do that. It's bad on several accounts. So just don't do that. But preparing your recommenders, there are things that you can do to streamline the process for them to make this process equitable, to make this process doable for them. And you won't be the only one applying to 6 schools in round 2, because others will also be doing this type of additional legwork for their recommenders.
Yeah, I could. And yeah, I think the best way to think of this is if you're applying to 6 schools and each school has, you know, 3 questions on the recommendation form, you might have this panic attack and say, wow, that's 18 questions. How on earth am I going to get my recommenders to do it? But if you do what Alex just recommended and you put them all into a single document and start to mix and match, you'll realize that, oh, wait a second. If my recommender answers these 5 questions, I've got all the material. They've got all the material they need to answer all kind of 18 of the individual, you know, school questions, because there's so much overlap. As Alex said, many of the schools are using the GMAC recommendation form, or they've agreed on questions to ask. So, yeah, it's not as bad as it looks. And, you know, Alex, we could do a whole episode on recommendations, and maybe we should at some point, because I think a lot of people, when their recommender comes to them and says, hey, you know what, you write it, I'll sign it, they think that that's like the best news ever. And there are many reasons why that's not good news at all. So we could talk about that for hours. Back to this candidate, though, I also wanted to mention that I think this idea of listing consulting as their short-term goal maybe robs them of a chance to really stand out in the applicant pool. So when I first saw their profile, I was saying, oh, cool, LA ad agency guy or gal. You don't see that very often. This person's going to be an interesting voice to have in the classroom. And I thought, you know, maybe they've enjoyed working on one type of product or service or company, you know, or industry. And so they could have a storyline around CPG, which is their, quote, second plan, or, you know, brand management, I think they mentioned, right? So I would rather hear that story for a set of goals. I think it would be, it'll probably resonate more and connect more with their past experience, and it allow them to differentiate rather than being, you know, one of the herd of, you know, folks. And obviously, as I can't remember who it was, but somebody in our essay workshop, one of the admissions directors, said yesterday, you know, the goals that you project in your essays, it's not like you're signing a contract and you have to do that. Like, obviously, if this person changes their mind and says, you know what, I really do want to do consulting, I think that's going to be the best fit for me after they've been at B school for a few months, then there's no one that's going to say, oh, but in your essay, you said CPG. So I'm not worried about that. I just think that if they think this through, I'm looking for places for them to connect the dots between what they've done to date and what they're going to do. And that seems like an easier task with CPG or kind of brand management or product management or something like that. Do you agree with that, or am I, you know, off the deep end?
Yeah, no, I agree with that. And I'll just add one additional thought to that. Now, I'm sure we talked about this before on this podcast, but it's always worth mentioning. It might sound to people listening for the first time, well, it's like I could just create any goal then that makes me sound sexy and interesting and this and that and the other. What's the point of ADCOM understanding this stuff if I could just create it? And the reason why ADCOM really want you to focus on your goals is, frankly, when you first start your MBA experience, you know, with the rigorous curriculum, which it is at the beginning, you cover a lot of ground very quickly. With the extracurricular activities and with the career management already knocking on your door in terms of, you know, companies visiting or doing whatever they do virtually at this point, you're going to be overwhelmed. So the only way to navigate a situation like that is to have a very good plan. So make sure that you recognize that this part of the application, the goals, the focus is fundamentally really, really important. But I agree with Graham. This candidate basically says, well, plan A is consulting, plan B would be consumer packaged goods brand management. Maybe plan B would be a more convincing case and compelling case in this scenario.
Yeah, well said. So I guess that's it. We've gone through our three candidates for this week. We think that all three might be undershooting a little bit. Like, we think that they could potentially you know, just aim higher and see what happens. But again, these were interesting. I think, you know, a lot of liberal arts type folks, sort of non-traditional. So fun to work through these profiles with you. You know, anything else, Alex? I mean, we'll be back in a week's time. I guess I wanted to wish everyone a really happy and healthy Thanksgiving. I know it's tough maybe for some folks who can't be with family if you're an American looking to celebrate. But hang in there. I feel like better times are ahead. And yeah, Alex, thanks for doing this as always.
Yeah, great. Thank you very much, Graham. Happy Thanksgiving, everybody. But most importantly, please stay safe. Good luck, everyone. Take care.